All right, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. The previous program was The Gary Noel Show, heard Monday through Friday at noon. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Michael S. Roth is a historian, curator, and teacher, and he's been the president of Wesleyan University since 2007, which means that he's no stranger to the debates that have been a regular part of American higher education recently. He has defended invitations to controversial speakers, notably those who are on the right, and he's called for institutions like his school to be as welcoming to conservative students as to liberals. In his latest book, Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses, he discusses how to defend free speech and campus values of inclusion, and also touches on issues of affirmative action. It's published by Yale University Press and brings Michael Roth to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Now, you write that this is a crucial time for education in America. Well, I attended college in the aftermath of the McCarthy era. Teachers had been fired. Many students at public universities like Berkeley and CUNY were politically radicalized. And then the Vietnam War had another impact. So why today in particular?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that a lot of people who write about education or involved in the administration of it tend to think that this, their own moment, must be the most crucial one. So I think there have been certainly other moments in the history of higher education that could be described as inflection points where you could have had McCarthyism not only destroy the lives and careers of many, many people, but they could have also destroyed the whole system of higher education. Likewise, in the Vietnam War, protests and counter-protests about the genocidal war in Southeast Asia was another inflection point. And today, I think colleges and universities are at a moment where there's a kind of partisan lack of confidence in the mission of higher education. And I think it's important for colleges and universities to continue to strive to provide avenues for social mobility for a diverse student body, while at the same time fostering intellectual diversity so that we can retain the confidence of a broad public who can see that educating young folks actually not only equips them for the job market, but also for civic participation.
Are the issues similar on public and private campuses?
You know, they're different at big schools and little schools, at private schools versus public institutions. And I've spent most of my career at pretty small private institutions. And the pressures from state politicians and from the law at big public institutions can be different than it is at private schools. But the task of faculty and administrators to create spaces for free inquiry and thoughtful consideration of a variety of viewpoints, that remains the same.
You write, and I'm quoting here, that wherever one stands on issues of affirmative action, most can agree that diversity isn't just about admissions, it's about the educational culture created by a university. But given the debates that are going on, do you think that universities do a good job with affirmative action?
Oh, well, we can always do a better job, Leonard. I think it's pretty clear that at fancy places, highly selective places like Wesleyan, where I teach and am the president, we have a much greater percentage of very wealthy students than we have of middle-income and low-income students. And that's a problem. I think many teachers and administrators recognize that. And we have a problem in trying to create not only realistic avenues for admission for people from diverse backgrounds, but once students get to campus, if they get to campus and then self-segregate and don't talk to people who come from different backgrounds or study things that don't challenge them intellectually, then the benefits of diversity get lost. So I think that colleges and universities have this great opportunity, which in an increasingly segregated and unequal America is rare. We have an opportunity to try to get students and faculty to interact across ideas and across different backgrounds in the search for better notions to deal with the challenges in front of us.
You say that there are at least three different debates going on about access to universities in the U.S. Three?
Well, there are lots of debates about access.
Okay, but what about the big three that you talk about? The first is about how to make college more affordable and reducing debt levels.
Yeah, so we have to make college more affordable for more people, and that does involve the big public institutions especially, and especially community colleges, which provide a great avenue at a reasonable price or sometimes free for students to find paths to advancement. Both of my sons went to community colleges in California, and both of them had classes that prepared them to do other things in education and beyond. And I think that public funding for community colleges and public state universities is absolutely crucial, and restoring the funding that had been cut after 2008 is so important. We also have to be aware of the great suspicion with which elite universities are regarded, because we admit somewhere between 5 and, let's say, 20% of the applicants, when probably about, and I know at Wesleyan, 75% of the applicants are actually qualified to do just fine. We have a small-scale education here, so we can't take more students to Wesleyan without changing the way we teach. But we have a duty to try to explain what holistic admissions means, how it's fair and how it's reasonable. On the other hand, it'll never seem reasonable to Jane to be rejected when her best friend Joan has exactly the same credentials and gets accepted. I think it's so important for high school juniors and seniors who are thinking about college to recognize that there are hundreds of great schools, at least in the United States, where students can thrive and learn the kinds of things that will stand them in good stead for the rest of their lives. And so the idea that you have to go to the school of the school du jour, the fashionable place this year, everybody wants to go to school X this year, that is pernicious. And so finding a way to remind people, as Frank Bruni put it in a book, where you go isn't who you are. And there are lots of interesting alternatives for high school juniors and seniors.
So you're bringing up the whole matter of how people are chosen for admission to highly selective colleges and universities has been a matter of debate. What has been the problem in the past?
Oh, well, I think the problem has always been, how do you define what counts as qualified to get the most out of the education one offers? And since the education, let's say, one offers at a place like, Wesleyan that I know best, or Vassar or Brown or the University of California at Berkeley, the education one offers is very hard to describe briefly, because if you're studying engineering, it's quite different than if you're studying classics. If you're studying biology or religion, you're going to have a different experience. So I think as we look at students who are eager to get a challenging and intense and socially beneficial education, we have to realize that they bring very many different things to the admissions marketplace. And as universities and colleges, we represent different things to them. So there is no particular formula to say that if you get X on an exam, then you're in. If you get X minus one, you're out. But I do think describing the kinds of students who will most benefit from the education we offer is part of our job. At Wesleyan, I often come across tour groups of high school kids and their families looking at colleges. And And they say things to me like, so why should my daughter come to Wesleyan? And I always say, I don't know if she should come to Wesleyan. There are a lot of really great schools out there. And the kind of students we want, students who are open to majoring in biology and theater, or who are going to do work at a very high level in religion, but also in physics, those are students quite different from the ones who might go to Yale or to Princeton or to a state university.
So talking about Yale and Princeton, do you have legacy students?
Do we have legacy students from Yale and Princeton?
No, sure. No. Do you have? We hear a lot about people who surprisingly got into great schools simply because their parents had gone to those great schools.
It's horrible. I think we certainly do have students whose parents went to Wesleyan, probably certainly well less than 10%. But they don't get in here because their parents went here. If anything, I think it's a higher bar. And I think there's no educational reason that I find acceptable to give a preference for family members.
Since there are only a limited number of spots, and you say that admissions shouldn't be based on a single exam or a group of exams, what do you think the best approach might be?
I'm not in the admissions office, and so
talk to them, right?
I do, but when I talk to them, we talk about the trying to find the combination of factors that show that students have not only had the privilege of getting a great high school education because they live in a good school district or they went to a fancy private school, but that they've shown they want to strive to be better at a variety of things than anyone expected them to be. And sometimes that means they did really well on exams, but sometimes it means they did pretty well, but everybody expected them to be terrible. Sometimes it means they bring a different perspective than we would have otherwise on the campus, and that they can work at the highest level. And at a place like Wesleyan, we want students who aren't motivated by competition or by simply trying to find a way to land the best internship. We want students who want to strive to do, well, sometimes we call it their personal best, to do better than they ever thought they can do, whether that's in economics or in athletics and or in theater. And because what that does is it makes for a really vibrant, interesting campus. But I have to say, in Safe Enough Spaces, I don't concentrate so much on the filters on how to get in. I concentrate more on once students are here, how do you make them feel included?
Still, we have seen people sue schools because they said, well, I did better on I brought in a better average from high school, and I did better on the admissions test, but this person was brought in because this person was, a person of color.
Yeah, we have seen those lawsuits, and there's still an interesting, important pending case up at Harvard. And I do think it's important for colleges and universities to promote having a diverse student body, and at the same time be flexible about that, what that means given their own campus culture and what they can offer students from a variety of backgrounds. Last year we celebrated the 50th anniversary of what we call the Vanguard class at Wesleyan, and 1969 students, black students who were admitted in much greater numbers than ever before to Wesleyan. And we celebrate that because they also occupied a building in 1969 to say, yeah, you brought us here. You brought us here, but you don't know how to educate people like us. And then you try to make us act like you guys. And I think the administration at the time was caught totally by surprise. And we gave
them. They thought they were doing them a big favor by letting them in, but not adjusting to the students.
Right. And it's got to be more than adjustment, Leonard. It's got to be figuring out how we can learn as much as possible from one another. And one of the members of that class received an honorary doctorate from us last year, Ed Sanders, who's went on to a distinguished career as a minister and as an activist. But he talked to me candidly about how challenging it was to be at a place where people said, oh, you just got in because of the color of your skin. Well, at the same time, not being able to access the best elements of the education we have to offer. Now, he came back 50 years later because he thinks it's a work in progress, and progress we've made, but we still have a ways to go.
I'm speaking to Michael S. Roth, who is the president of Wesleyan University in Connecticut, the author of a number of books. His most recent, Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. It's published by Yale University Press. I've read that in many of the most selective institutions, more undergraduates come from the top 1% of the income bracket than from the bottom 60%. So how much of that is the result of the systemic problems in K-12 education?
I think a great deal of it. I think that today, many schools that are highly selective are eager to find students from low-income families who can successfully access the education they have to offer. That is, they're prepared by their middle school and high school to do the work that's going to be required on that college campus. For many years, as truth be told, these schools didn't look for those students. But today, I think, rightly, they are looking for very qualified low-income students. But the system we have in the United States that bases the quality of your high school education on the wealth of the real estate of the school district, in many cases, that leads to incredibly unequal educational opportunities for students in high school. So students come to a university from a very good high school, having already had, let's say, calculus at least once, maybe twice, and students who did very well at their own high school, but never actually had a chance to even learn what calculus was, let alone take classes in it. And so the person from the first group, she's going to do just fine. She's going to look like a star because she's seen the material before. And the other person is going to have an extremely hard time in those first 2 years just catching up. And I remember when I came to Wesleyan in 1975, a long time ago, I went to a big public high school on Long Island. I had never heard of a place like this at Wesleyan. I had never met anyone who went to a private school who hadn't gotten expelled from the public school. And I met these people who had really, really great educations. And I felt I had to work twice as hard just to stay even or close behind. And my school district wasn't that bad. It just wasn't the kind of place that valued academic work. And so that unequal high school experience, I think, accounts for a lot of the problem of a lack of equality at the university level.
In some cases, that unequal high school experience is based on decisions made by the kid. In my case, I chose to take STEM and typing instead of calculus.
Yeah.
And then I went to college and had to take college math.
There you go. Now, I was had the good fortune of going to Wesleyan when there were no requirements. There still aren't. And so I was able to avoid math for a while. but today, you know, I see that the especially in the STEM fields where it's so important to get a good start. You know, I'm a historian. You can take medieval history after modern history. It's okay. But, you know, you can't take Calc 3 before you take Calc 1 or organic chemistry and so on. And so for those very important fields that have a linear path, it's a great disadvantage if you don't have a strong high school background.
Where does the recent scandal of very wealthy parents paying the equivalent of bribes to get their children into elite schools fit into this story?
Well, I think it's a symptom of the problem of inequality. It's a sick symptom, and it's salacious and all that. But I think the deeper problem is that poverty is perpetuated because of the education system we have. I mean, if very rich people and celebrities are often going to find a way to get more stuff for their kids. That's not a good thing. But the bigger problem are the hundreds of thousands of people who live in poverty or near poverty who don't have an opportunity to get out of poverty because we don't give them an educational experience in middle school or elementary school and high school that prepares them to change their lives.
A number of candidates are proposing free higher education for everyone. How are people in the various universities responding to that? People like you, administrators.
Well, you know, I think that making college affordable is a great thing. Making college free for everybody so that people who can afford to pay don't pay is a really bad idea. So at a place like Wesleyan, about half our students are on financial aid, and the average grant is probably over $50,000 now. Those people, you know, if it were free for them, even better. I mean, they have significant financial aid. But the fact that some people can pay is important. And I don't think it's wise to sloganeer this, to say a free college for everyone. I think it's let's make it affordable. And that means some people can pay some. Some people won't pay anything. And people who've gotten a lot of benefits from our system, they could pay for it.
Well, things have changed over the years. And up through maybe the 70s or 80s, the City University was free to anyone who passed the test. You just paid lab fees.
Yeah.
And then that all changed, probably because of just the economics of government and different political winds.
Yeah, and I do think that in the public sector and city colleges and community colleges, I think removing all economic barriers is absolutely crucial. And, you know, there are people there in CUNY now, I think of Kathy Davidson and others, who have really done a great work in not just making sure that there's no tuition for people who don't have financial capacity, but they also take care of transportation costs. They're aware of food costs. Leonard, I was surprised at Wesleyan that students on full scholarship were complaining to me that during break we don't have food for them. And and I thought, gee whiz, you're having a full scholarship. But then I realized these are students who are working two jobs. They're sending money home to their families during the school year. And during the, say, the long winter break that we have at a place like Wesleyan, they actually are stuck. And so one of our students, she took it upon herself to gather food from all these other people who were wasting food. And during winter, she set up a food pantry. And I tell you, it opened my eyes. So now we're going to make sure there's food available for that certain number of students who really are struggling economically. Because if we can take away some of the economic struggle, then they can really soar on the educational level.
In your book, you address the criticisms from the last decades of the last century of Alan Bloom and Richard Bernstein, two social critics who didn't always agree on all topics, but seemed to agree that multiculturalism on American university campuses had become a sterile orthodoxy. What were they arguing 25 and 30 years ago, and how does that apply to the debates of today?
Well, Alan Bloom really set this template, I think, in the closing of the American mind, both in the sense that he showed that a book, in some ways a challenging book, intellectually challenging book about higher education could become a bestseller and thereby change the station of the author. and that there was an appetite for complaints about young people that would be put in philosophical form. And I say it that way because there's something in Bloom and his successors of kids, what's the matter with kids today, you know, the Bye Bye Birdie song. Because it was, you know, Bloom, he had a point that he took from his teacher, Leo Strauss, that somehow the modern world was abandoning universal values and developing an idea, an idea of tolerance that made all serious inquiry meaningless because you never really were going to get a foundational answer. Bloom took that point and he kind of plugged it into his disgruntlement as an older man about rock and roll, about the sexual mores of at least heterosexual students. And that was a winning formula for middle-aged readers to look down at the young generation. And Bernstein was less of that. Bernstein, I think, was
Let's talk about Bloom a bit more.
Because, okay, sure.
Because I was always curious about this even way back then. If he was arguing that students had been inculcated since they were school children with the prejudice that tolerance is the greatest virtue and everyone should have their own truth, why is that bad? Is tolerance a bad thing?
From his perspective, it was a bad thing because some answers are right and some answers are wrong. And if you don't think that's a legitimate statement, some answers are right and some are wrong, then you're just going to tolerate any kind of answer that comes along, and you won't strive to actually find what is the deepest, most profound, most powerful way of living for yourself.
Isn't there something called nuance?
Well, he actually thought, as and others in his shared that worldview, that if you didn't have a foundation, then you were going to end up with relativism. That once the modern philosophy got rid of the idea of natural right and foundations for universal laws, they disarmed themselves against making distinctions of any kind. Now, and he had an argument for that, not just in that book, but, you know, he was part of a school of philosophy that had that argument. I don't share that view myself, but I think what was powerful in the book was that he connected that argument to a critique about youth culture, and he tried to show that tolerance had disarmed people. So. And not just make them nice to be with, but actually made them vacuous. And Francis Fukuyama, who's had some connection to that way of thinking in the University of Chicago, perhaps, or Cornell, in his picture of the end of history, where everybody's just sitting around watching TV or playing video games because there's nothing is more important than anything else, that was their nightmare vision of culture. And it really caught on for a certain demographic, I guess, and it set a template for people to complain then about political correctness in the 90s, or about excellent sheep in our own time, or coddled minds. I mean, this was really both a ticket for writing a book that would sell and a rhetorical move to complain about people, young people who, geez, they're not just like we were.
And Bernstein, did he argue a similar point?
Well, Richard Bernstein, I think, is related to that, but not exactly the same. I don't know either. I didn't know Alan Bloom when he was alive. I corresponded with him briefly, and I don't know Richard Bernstein personally. But Richard Bernstein, I think, as a liberal.
More like a middle of the roader.
In those days, I think he would have thought himself a liberal anyway. He felt outflanked by people on the left who saw themselves as rooting out prejudice and discrimination, and Bernstein saw them as dangerously on a path to authoritarianism. That some of this, so he uses Robespierre as the kind of devil out there, that we're all going to be subject to these today we would say the Ayatollah of tolerance, or the czar of virtue, or the dictatorship of virtue is what Robespierre called it. And I think, again, what happens to some middle of the roaders or liberals is when, as students do their own political thing, they outflank us. They outflank this position. And Bernstein didn't like being outflanked. And he also thought there was a kind of sanctimonious authoritarianism in that multiculturalism. And we've all seen people get up on their high horse to attack others about some perhaps a slight or some unintentional, what we'd call today, microaggressions. But Bernstein makes that into, he even compares it to Maoism. And I'm quite critical of that. You know, Mao's regime killed tens of millions of people. Bernstein's examples are people losing jobs, which is sad, or people feeling offended, which is not so sad. So I do think it was this hyperbolic critique of young people who were kind of cutting their progressive teeth on a variety of efforts to make the world less mean, less discriminatory, and less racist. Sometimes they may go overboard, but who's to say? They also are making us more aware of the prejudices that seep into our work.
He argued that the doctrine of assimilation had been replaced by a celebration of difference, and that strident anti-immigration sentiments and organized nativism were things of the past. Well, is he still alive? He's welcome to America today.
I know. I commented just on that passage in the book because I think it's a sad commentary on our times. It's not Richard Bernstein's fault, really, that when he wrote that, it seemed plausible. And today, when we see organized racism energizing the caging of children at the border, it's nativism run amok and at the highest levels.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Whether I say my rhyme fast, slow, sloppy, and neat, see, I wish when I do it to have freedom of speech.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press.
Now, if they ban me, I don't give up. Chalk it up an experience.
Yeah, bad luck.
Because I'm balling with Laylaw's clout. And if he say that it stays, it comes out. Because in the early days when rap first began, some fool jumped up and said it tune would end. But nowadays, I hear song after song, and it proved to me that the fool was wrong.
We are back with Michael S. Roth, president of Wesleyan University, whose latest book is Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses, published by Yale University Press. And it occurs to us, Michael, that our audience might want to join this conversation. Would that be okay if we took a few listener calls?
Oh.
Hello? Are you there?
He's there.
He is there. Michael Roth?
I'm still here.
Okay, good. Did you hear what I just said about taking calls?
Yes, I'm sorry. I said that. Of course, that's fine.
Okay, well, let me give out the number in case somebody out there, but we hope that they'll really stick to the point here. The number is 212-209-2877. That's our on-air number, 212-209-2877. We have... kind of skirted around the whole idea of political correctness, but that's a major part of your book. You ask if some African Americans can be accused of being oversensitive about stop and frisk and whether transgender people are thin-skinned if they're concerned with bans against their participation in public life or even using certain restrooms. You say that name-calling or assuming the status of the victimized are among the least productive forms of disagreement.
Right. Well, I those examples I use in the context of pushing back against those who complain that young people or progressives have gotten too sensitive. And so I use those examples like, who's to say whether those are legitimate complaints? And I think the answer is the people impacted by those practices should be able to say. And that when people in positions like mine or other faculty members or journalists say, well, folks are getting too sensitive. I think they don't recognize the persistent use of discriminatory practices against vulnerable populations. And we shouldn't speak for them and say, oh, they're getting too sensitive. We should listen to the things that continue to marginalize or worst those populations.
As a school president, do you hear different kinds of complaints from students, faculty, and I guess it's citizens of the general public or the parents?
Different from 10 years ago?
Well, I mean, are they arguing for different things?
Oh, I see. Yes, there are certainly very many differences among the student body and even among the faculty that we don't see that much of in the media. I'll give you an example. In the book called for a affirmative action plan for conservative thinking on campuses, and I had done something similar in an op-ed a couple of years ago. And so a group of religious students came to see me. They called themselves students of faith. Asked me to participate in an event they were holding with an evangelical intellectual who was going to visit the campus, and I said, you know, that's not my thing. I'm an atheist Jew, and I don't know if I'm the right guy. And they said, well, you're in favor of intellectual diversity, you should participate. And so eventually I said, oh yeah, you're right, I should do this. And I, when I went there, I thought there would be, I don't know, a dozen people or so to have a small conversation. And there were, you know, 120 people there who were eager to talk about the ways in which being a religious person at a selective liberal arts school like Wesleyan actually might put them at a disadvantage in front of some faculty. Now, that's a point of view of students and of faculty members that I hadn't heard before. And I take very seriously. And there, you know, every year I learn from students and from their families how we can do a better job of allowing the students to bring them their whole selves to class, but also making the university more responsive in a serious way to what they need to learn and what they want to know.
We have a call. We're going to put it on the air now. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello?
Yes. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Listen, I've been away from the radio for about a year. I was shocked to find out that you moved from NPR to BAI. I'm glad to hear you on any format, though. I'd love at some point to hear your thoughts on, you know, what caused that move. But I know that's not the topic
right now. We have talked about it. I'm sorry you missed it. But what do you want to talk about on the topic of at hand?
Okay, so I'd like to ask you a guess. Where would you put, I'm an African-American male in my 60s, lived in New York all my life. Where would you guess put the issue of, for instance, Black Lives Matter within that whole conversation of liberals moving from a traditional bootstrap up thing into a multicultural conceptualization of society now?
Well, shall I go ahead, Leonard?
Yes, please.
So I think the Black Lives Matter movement accentuated awareness for many of us at colleges, universities, that the civil rights struggle continues. And it has to continue in a powerful way to defend people against state violence and to create opportunities for people who have been over many, many years systematically denied those opportunities. And so I was in an interesting position, I think. It was interesting as a university president because I had heard from my friends on the faculty and students that there was going to be a Black Lives Matter demonstration at the height of that movement. And then I got a call from the mayor of Middletown, the city in which Wesleyan is, and telling me, you know, they're going to disrupt traffic and, you know, you got to get them to move the demonstration. Well, actually, I was publicized demonstration. I thought it was a good thing for us to have solidarity around this issue. And I told the mayor, it's not in my power to tell the demonstrators where to march. In fact, if I did, they would tell me something I couldn't repeat on the radio. But my wife and I mean, she's on the faculty at Wesleyan also, we joined the demonstration because I thought it was important, although my position is different from, of course, an African-American student or worker in Middletown, I thought it was important to show solidarity and concern. And I have to say the city of Middletown did a great job of protecting the demonstrators, removing traffic. And although there were some people in the demonstration who tried to bait the police did a great job, actually, of making sure it all went down smoothly and the demonstration could take place. And so I think that there are moments like that when people can pull together around issues of expanding civil rights in ways that are in accord with our already articulated views of justice and equality.
But you mentioned demonstrations. We're seeing fewer demonstrations on campuses these days against the issues of social injustice and war in a larger society. Now many students seem to be interested in policing the language of their professors in the classroom. And although these aren't I've been made aware of a number of recent incidents that aren't in your book, but still are germane to this conversation. For instance, a New School professor, Laurie Sheck, quoted James Baldwin, noting that he had not said, "I am your Negro," the title of a recent documentary by Raoul Peck, but "I am not your," and I can't say the word on the N-word. Professor Sheck asked her students what they made of Baldwin using the N-word, and a student lodged a complaint against her that a white person should never have said the N-word, and the university bureaucracy then went through its process calling Sheck in and asking her to explain her actions when she was quoting James Baldwin.
I know, it's a horrible thing, and I think the universe, I don't know beyond the facts, beyond what I've, like what you just said, what I've read in the press, and that the university then said she didn't do anything wrong. Now, should they have investigated in the first place? I mean, I don't know how much choice they have if a particular student, who may actually be just annoyed about something else, lodges a complaint. I teach the same book in my class, and I said to the students, just as you did, Leonard, just now, I said, listen, James Baldwin doesn't say N-word. He articulates the word that's spelled out, but I'm not going to do that in this class. And let's agree that that's what we're going to do. We're going to use the word N-word. Although I'm not going to change the Baldwin text. You have to deal with that. And some of you think that's appropriate or inappropriate. We could talk about that, but you know, let's give ourselves a space where we can have that conversation and agree that. We agree with the condition I said that we're going to use the phrase N-word.
But an even less touchy word, a Columbia professor, Todd Gitlin, was teaching an undergraduate course and happened to mention that in the 1950s, the accepted term for African-American was Negro. And a student took great offense at this, said that she refused to listen to anything else a professor said. And then Columbia's college newspaper Spectator wrote that the problem was how sensitive were elderly white professors to the woke sensibilities of their diverse students.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as a teacher, that seems to me a horrific example. On the other hand, any day at Columbia University or at Wesleyan, you'll find dozens and dozens of times these words are used without incident. And you know, we live in America. Anybody can complain about anything. Anybody can sue somebody about something. And in universities that have become luxury goods, where people expect to get concierge service, people complain about words that cause offense. But I do think sensationalizing specific complaints about relatively well-known professors is probably not the best way to understand students more generally. I mean, I teach courses every year. They're pretty large for our campus, in which we deal with very sensitive subjects from childhood sexual abuse to genocide. And I do try to prepare the students for what they're about to encounter by telling them, you know, what's in the course. And they come back and they deal with it. And I've had a student stand up and say, you shouldn't be allowed to teach a rape memoir, Roth, because you are part of a system of rape culture. And I said, I respect your view, but we're going to do this reading. This is part of the course. And you know, you as a teacher, you often have students who rebel against what you are doing. And going to the press with an account of complaints is probably not the best pedagogical strategy. There are other ones to try to get students to listen to things they may not want to hear but need to hear.
Well, let's take some more calls. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I heard you earlier talking about how there's less demonstrations on college campuses. And I know Mr. Roth a lot of times talks about how Wesleyan is big on free speech and big on protests and respects that. But recently in April, police were actually called on peaceful student protesters. And while that can't really be put directly on Michael Roth, he did nothing afterwards. You know, the dean, Rick Colton, was involved with that. And as you can hear, at times Roth is quite paternalistic regarding student protesters and just sort of takes that stance over them. And then when people actually protest, Wesleyan takes such a harsh stance against them. So I'm just really seeing a lot of difference between Michael Roth's rhetoric and his actual actions on campus.
You have a critic.
I do, and I have many critics, and And in that case, I don't know who actually called the police from the administration because the protesters, at least these folks, felt they were being pushed physically. And so police showed up, and that was the extent of the intervention. But there are, you know, there are protests at Wesleyan on a regular basis about topics ranging from climate change to, you know, workers' rights on campus. And I do try to be respectful without being paternalistic, but clearly not everybody thinks I'm doing that successfully.
So let's bring another caller in. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I was listening to you before. Well, first off, I like what you said about truth. You know, there is truth and there is non-truth in the world. And it seems like in our society, we've gotten into thinking that, you know, this relative way of thinking that, you know, it's anybody's truth. You could argue all day that gravity doesn't exist. You could hold your breath, whatever, but it does exist. So I like what you said about that. But you were touching on education, too. I don't know if you touched on the fact that we have problems with education in our society. You know, I just make a comment on that. I think it stems, I think it's complex. Part of it stems from a victim-type mentality, like everybody's a victim. And when you're a victim, you're a perfect person. You can't do any wrong. And when you go in with that attitude, you know, nobody could tell you anything. I think a lot of the problems in education in our society is, I think, stem from behavior problems and just attitude problems and lack of respect for education and educators, particularly those who don't look like you.
Well, I thank you for the comment. I think that as a pragmatist in the history of philosophy,
and you call yourself a pragmatist.
I call myself a pragmatist, and you know, I was very much influenced by my teacher Richard Rorty in this regard. I mean, there are some things that hold up pretty well, like the law of gravity, and there are other truths that seem much more contingent or convenient, and I don't think we need to have a general view. In fact, I think probably people, almost no one except a professional philosopher, would have a general view about these notions. As far as victims, I teach this course. I will be teaching this fall. It's Virtue and Vice from Confucius to Spike Lee, and we actually end up with Maggie Nelson and other writers of the contemporary moment. And I'm very interested in the ways in which victims become the moral heroes at a certain point in especially American culture. But I think of that less as something just to condemn, as an interesting feature of how we're trying to adjust to the persistence of systematic injustice in our society. And I don't want to be just a critic of the valuation or the making heroes out of victims. I want to actually understand why it is that our moral heroes tend to be survivors in these days. And my students seem more eager to read about that than to read Aquinas, but we try to do both in the class.
You talk about mostly supporting free speech on campus. Libertarians argue that if anyone is excluded from speaking, we're on a slippery slope to censorship. So who would be justifiably barred by, first let's do a private campus, and then maybe we can also talk about public campuses. Where would we draw the line?
Yeah, that's a great question, Leonard, and I'm not going to have a great answer. I'll because I don't know that there's a clear line. I do think we always make judgments about this. Some things child pornography would be over the line. My hero
incitement to violence.
Incitement to violence. My hero as a young professor was a president of Pomona College. I taught in Claremont, California in those days. David Alexander, when he found out that this group, I think they were called the Revisionist History Society, innocuous name, but they were a bunch of Orange County Nazis. They had rented space on the campus, and the college attorney, at least in the story I know, said, you know, we can't do anything about it. They signed a contract, and he marched in and said, get off my campus and, you know, you can sue me, but I will not host Nazis. And our scientists don't have to host flat earthers, and we don't have to host fascists or people who come to campus merely with the intention of intimidation and harassment.
Well, there was a lot of controversy a couple of years ago when Milo Yiannopoulos was booked to speak at UC Berkeley. He had worked on the Trump campaign, and people protested that in his speeches he has ridiculed Islam, feminism, social justice, and he has also been accused of being an apologist for pedophilia. And he wound up being allowed to give the speech after there was quite a bit of controversy and a lot of divisive debate on the issue. So how far do we go? Do we allow him to speak? Do we allow Representative Steve King to speak? Or President Trump, who's been accused of making racist and anti-Semitic statements and supporting white supremacists?
Yeah, it's a great question. I when I started writing about this, we didn't have neo-fascists at the highest level of government, and so I thought it was pretty clear that you invite people who you might find offensive, but who are not engaged in direct intimidation and harassment of people based on their race or their religion their sexual orientation. And that line, it gets blurry, I think, when you have people with significant influence who are making arguments that are also intimidators and harassers. So I think that it'll vary from school to school because the culture of the school will determine what kind of speaker can be productively tolerated and listened to. I mean, the goal is not to show how great you are about free speech. The goal is actually to learn from people who give talks on campus. Unless we're talking just about entertainment and you want to invite a provocateur just to provoke people, I suppose then there will be demonstrations. I like to think you can have demonstrations and still let the event take place. But there are times, as recently happened in right here in Connecticut this week, there was a neo-Nazi invited to speak in central Connecticut, and there was enough protest, so the guy backed out. I actually think that's a good thing that the protesters made it clear that they were not going to tolerate overt racism hiding behind free speech. Now, I say that knowing that, you know, you some people see this as a slippery slope. So when we had this great debate a few years ago at Wesleyan, when a conservative student wrote an op-ed critical of Black Lives Matter, there was a lot of protest on campus. I wrote a piece called Black Lives Matter, So Does Free Speech. And so people thought I was more free speechy than they wanted. And then Jelani Cobb wrote a piece in The New Yorker saying free speech talk is often just a cover for racism. And I invited Professor Cobb to come and speak at Wesleyan to make that case. And I think what worked well about that is that the students then could see, they were excited about Professor Cobb coming. They could see not that Roth and Cobb agreed, but that they could actually have dinner together. They could have an argument. They could talk about things, and that the conversation continued. You want to be in a situation where whoever you bring to campus, whatever they instigate, leads to a conversation that continues, that can be productive of helping people learn things.
On the other hand, political correctness is a reason that some comics, including Jerry Seinfeld and Bill Maher, say they've stopped doing shows at campuses.
Yeah, I don't buy that. That's like, you know, when Frank Sinatra would say, nobody invites me to sing at a punk rock venue. Mm-hmm. I just think that's entertainers just getting old. I mean, my daughter's just graduated college. She shows me the stuff she watches on TV. You know, my wife has to leave the room because it's so raunchy. I don't think political correctness gets in the way of raunchy comedy. I think the particular way in which those comics got laughs is just not so funny to people today.
Now, we have very little time, but I wanted to sneak one more caller in. BAI, you're on the air. Could you make it brief?
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Yeah, this is Robert. I live out of Carolina, North Carolina, and I was just listening to, you all talk about the college campus and whatnot. But I'm 48 years old, and the way I look at it is I think a campus should be a learning, not a riot, not a free speech era, because you know, that could not want kids to go to a certain college, just like you were saying earlier. I mean, you know, it's like, well, they got too much drama over here, over this campus. They got this free speech era over here. I don't like it. And it's a thing they ought to just leave out of colleges. I mean, period. If you want a free speech, go to an NFL football stadium and give out tickets. Whoever want to go, let them go. But as far as bringing stuff on campus where, you know, you might have mixed children. You might have a kid that's got a Chinese mom and a black daddy or you know, and they don't know how to take issues like
but,
that.
But when some football players have kneeled, they have been punished for doing that. Isn't that a form of free speech?
It's not where you want to bring drama, okay? I mean, you're saying these kids paying all this money to go to college.
Are you surprised to hear this?
Not really. I think that parents of our students really want their students to learn. They want the spaces to be safe enough so they can learn, not so safe that they don't hear anything from alternative points of view. And you know, protest is part of that. Sometimes it gets boisterous. Sometimes it gets dramatic. But most of the time, I think people find a way to keep the conversation going so they can hear things they wouldn't have heard otherwise, meet people they wouldn't have met otherwise, and learn things that will expand their world.
Michael S. Roth is president of Wesleyan University and a historian, a curator, a teacher. His previous books include Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters. The one we've been discussing is Safe Enough Spaces, a pragmatist's approach to inclusion, free speech, and political correctness on college campuses, published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to our live engineer, Reggie Johnson, and our executive producer, Jesse Lent, for all of their help throughout the week. If you're new to our show and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're also available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopait at Large on Facebook and Twitter and on our website, leonardlopaitatlarge.com, where you can find links to all of our past shows. The Tom Hartman program is up next, and we hope you'll join us again on Monday when Bill McKibben will discuss his latest book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? And with that in mind, have a great weekend.
Hello, people. This is Howard Jordan of the Jordan Journal. And every Friday from 3 to 5 p.m., we will be providing you with the utmost coverage of the issues of the day. Every Friday from 3 to 5 p.m., stay tuned. Listen to the Jordan Journal and don't forget to make a donation to the station. And like I tell you every week, God loves you and I do too.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI New York, and WBAI.org online. The previous program was Leonard Lopait at Large, heard Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. Stay tuned for the Tom Hartman program, but first, news headlines from Democracy Now!
The United Nations is calling for the protection of the Amazon amidst fears that thousands of fires raging across Brazil are rapidly destroying the world's largest rainforest and paving the way for a climate catastrophe. On Thursday, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres tweeted, "In the midst of this global climate crisis, we cannot afford more damage to a major source of oxygen and biodiversity. The Amazon must be protected," he said. The fires have spread a vast plume of smoke across South America and the Atlantic Ocean that's visible from space. They're unprecedented in recorded history, and environmentalists say most of the fires were deliberately set by illegal miners and cattle ranchers. French President Emmanuel Macron called the Amazon fires an international crisis, said they should top the agenda this weekend as leaders of the G7 countries gather in Paris. Macron tweeted, "Our house is burning, literally." Indigenous people in Amazonia say the government of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro is encouraging the destruction. This is Indigenous leader Handa Kwakana Mura.
And with each passing day, we see the destruction advance, deforestation, invasion, logging. We are sad because the forest is dying at every moment. We feel the climate changing, and the world needs the forest. We need the forest, and our children need the forest.
Bolsonaro has long made racist comments about indigenous people. In 1998, a Brazilian newspaper quoted him as saying, "It's a shame that the Brazilian cavalry hasn't been as efficient as the Americans who exterminated the Indians," Bolsonaro said. In the United States, Senator Bernie Sanders Thursday proposed a sweeping 10-year, $16 trillion plan that would rapidly transition the U.S. energy sector.